The headlines: Palestine's foreign ministry condemns the unlawful Israeli raid on the offices of several Palestinian human rights groups in the occupied West Bank. A new survey shows 7 out of 10 Germans are using less energy amid the country's decades-high inflation and fears of Russian gas supply cuts. And North Korea turns down the South's offer of economic aid to return for denuclearization. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Palestine's foreign ministry has strongly condemned the Thursday Israeli raid on offices of several Palestinian NGOs in the occupied West Bank. The ministry, in a statement, called the raid unlawful. It said Israeli forces looted documents and seized equipment at the offices before shutting them down. The offices belong to Palestinian human rights groups and civil society organizations. The foreign ministry warned that civil society and human rights defenders remain as the prime target of the apartheid Israeli regime. Now, that is because, the ministry said, they play a key role in monitoring and documenting Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. It called on the international community to provide urgent protection for the groups targeted on Thursday.
The Israeli military shut down 7 Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations. They are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was, any organization talked about, exposed the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes, will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and, of course, also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed 6 of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The 7th organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful. The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
A new survey shows 7 out of 10 Germans are using less energy amid a surge in costs due to decades-high inflation in Europe's largest economy. The survey by a Berlin-based research group, Infratest-Damp, shows those using less energy is up from 63% in April. A 35% raise in energy costs in the second quarter pushed Germany's inflation into 8.5%. The country is facing an energy crunch due to decreased gas supplies from Russia. Moscow cites technical reasons, but Berlin calls it politically motivated. The energy regulator says gas reserves will only be enough to run heating and industrial facilities for over 2 months if Russia completely halts supplies. That has prompted Germany to stockpile gas and accelerate its transition to green energies. Chancellor Olaf Scholz is expected to sign a deal to establish hydrogen supply chain with Canada in his upcoming trip. Scholz is also discussing the prospects of Canadian LNG deliveries to Germany. A fresh round of rail strikes has gotten underway across the UK, bringing travel chaos to millions of travelers for the next 3 days. The move comes after long-running negotiations between trade unions and the government over pay and working conditions failed to produce an agreement. Said Puraza reports.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years. As the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes and actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saipur is up, London.
North Korea rejects an offer by its southern neighbor to help boost the North's economy in exchange for nuclear disarmament. Kim Yo-jong, sister of the North Korean leader, said the South Korean president should, quote, shut his mouth. She called Seoul's offer ignorant and at the height of a folly far from realization. Yo-jong said the idea of exchanging Pyongyang's nuclear power with economic cooperation is just a dream of Seoul. South Korea has expressed regret over its neighbor's pledge to continue nuclear development. The South's President Yoon Suk-yeol made the offer on Wednesday, calling for talks with Pyongyang. The North says its nuclear program is for self-defense. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, joined us earlier to tell us more about the tensions on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korea is extremely angry because the South is about to hold large-scale military drills in the field with the U.S. for the first time since 2017. And from the 16th to the 19th this week, it has been holding preliminary exercises with the U.S. in the field in preparation for those large-scale drills, which will run from August 22nd to September 1st this year. And they have been sending self-propelled howitzers out into the field. And at the same time, they are making this type of offer to North Korea, which does not even go as far as the offer made by U.S. President Trump to the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un during the summits, the historic summits held for the first time between the U.S. and the North, which of course fell apart over differences between how much the North was willing to denuclearize and how much the Trump administration was willing to lift sanctions and offer security guarantees.
Brazil's former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, keeps his lead over incumbent Jair Bolsonaro less than 2 months before presidential elections there. According to a new poll, leftist Lula da Silva has a 47% support among likely voters. For right-wing Bolsonaro, the support is 32%, and that is up by 3% compared to a poll last month. But there is still a 15-point gap between the two rivals. On Tuesday, they officially launched their campaigns for what is believed to be the most polarized presidential race in Brazil. The election is set to be held on the 2nd of October. A runoff will follow if none of the garners vote, none of them gain more than 50% of the vote in the first round. Recent elections in South American countries, including Chile and Colombia, show voters have launched left-wing candidates. Earlier, we're joined by our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Camila Escalante, to get more details on the recent poll in Brazil.
Lula da Silva currently has more support than all of the other candidates combined, which means he could potentially win, based on these numbers, in the first round without need for a second round runoff election. And of course, the reason why he wasn't able to participate in the 2018 elections was because in the spring of that year, he was targeted in a lawfare campaign, and he was charged with a lot of bogus, made-up charges that landed him in jail in Curitiba, Paraná, a state to the south of Sao Paulo, where thousands of people rallied outside of that prison demanding his release. He remained in prison throughout the campaign, and ultimately Jair Bolsonaro ran against a less popular leftist candidate, Fernando Haddad, and that leftist candidate lost. But there was overwhelming support during that election for Lula da Silva as well. And so, you know, that prevented the left from returning to power in those previous elections. And Lula remains just as popular now. A lot of the people who supported Bolsonaro in 2018 no longer support him because of how detrimental his neoliberal policies have been for the economies of regular Brazilian people here who have seen their material conditions slide down and deteriorate.
A delegation from Iran headed by the country's Ministry for Roads and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, has visited Pakistan. During the visit, the two countries agreed to finalize a free trade agreement within the next 6 months. Nasser Kazmi reports.
Iranian Minister for Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasemi, along with the delegation of 57 dignitaries from Iran, visited Islamabad on the sidelines of 21st session of Pak-Iran Joint Economic Commission. During the two-day visit, the Iranian delegation met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and discussed the bilateral ties between the two countries. Pakistan's Foreign Minister underlined the need to fully utilize the existing potential between Islamabad and Tehran in energy and air links. Addressing a press conference with the Iranian Roads and Urban Development Minister, Pakistan's Minister for Commerce, Naveed Qamar, said both sides have agreed to start negotiations on transit agreements that will allow the movement of goods without any additional taxes or tariffs.
We agreed on time frames for the PTA, which is to be negotiated between the two countries. And an ambitious target of 6 months has been set for that process.
The visiting Iranian minister, Rustam Qasimi, said the 21st session of Pakistan-Iran Joint Economic Commission offers new avenues for expanding bilateral ties between Pakistan and Iran. He noted, in order to increase bilateral trade, both sides are ready to establish border markets, which will later be made free economic zones to enable investors of both countries to set up their industries for import and export purposes.
I believe that the implementation of these agreements will play a significant role in raising the quality of life of the people of the two sides, especially the border markets, transportation, and the exchange of goods between the two countries.
Islamabad has assured Tehran that it is committed to taking all possible measures to increase bilateral trade volume to the level of $5 billion in near future.
Besides signing different MOUs in the fields of transport, trade and business, both Pakistan and Iran also stressed the need of making visa conditions easier to facilitate the traders and visitors from both sides. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have taken up explanation of Surah Hadid, which is number 57, in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran, and mentions the heavy metallic element called hadid or iron as being sent down by God to endow the earth itself with mighty force and provide humanity with the many benefits of its structural strength, as well as all the great tests of faith that arise from this. The surah presents several divine attributes, then proceeds with the grandeur of the Noble Quran, the state of the believers and hypocrites on the day of resurrection, accounts of the past nations and spending in the way of Allah for establishment of social justice. It criticizes monasticism and social seclusion and mentions the response received from the public by the previous prophets. We continue from where we left you last Friday, and here is Ayah 21.
سابقوا إلى مغفرة من ربكم وجنة عرضها كعرض السماء والأرض أعدت للذين آمنوا بالله ورسله ذلك فضل الله يؤتيه من يشاء والله ذو الفضل العظيم.
Take the lead toward forgiveness from your Lord and a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth, prepared for those who have faith in Allah and His prophets. That is Allah's grace, which He grants to whomever He wishes. And Allah is dispenser of a great grace. If you remember, last week, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said the transient life of the mortal world is not the end, but is a passage towards the hereafter and resurrection for the day of judgment, on which the believers will be rewarded and the disbelievers condemned to eternal punishment. This means it is the proper cognizance of the world and its characteristics that make a person immune from the dangers of disbelief and sins, since excessive attachment to materialistic life is nothing but drifting away from truth and the realities of creation. In other words, life without faith in God and failure to observe spiritual values is just a childish play. It is true that all human beings enjoy the life of the world to varying degrees, including the believers who consider as gifts of God Almighty. But the real bounties are those of the hereafter, where bliss is achieved because of faith and good deeds, while disbelief and sins lead to permanent punishment. The ayah that we recited to you now emphasizes hastening toward divine forgiveness through repentance, self-reform, expiation for missed obligations, obedience to God Almighty, and refraining from sins. Thus, divine forgiveness is actually the key to paradise, whose vastness encompasses the heavens and the earth and is prepared for the believers. Divine forgiveness is necessary before tidings of paradise, because unless a person is absolved of sins, he or she will not be admitted to paradise. A point to note is that paradise, with its numerous bounties, is not obtained through our good deeds, which are indeed insignificant, but it is divine grace, mercy, and favor that multiplies a believer's virtuous acts and makes him or her deserving of the bliss of paradise. This ayah teaches us that, number one, if the life of the world is amusement and pleasures of the flesh for the sinners and disbelievers, it is an excellent opportunity for obeying God's commandments and abstaining from forbidden acts and things for the believers who strive for divine mercy and forgiveness. Number two, the faithless and materialists compete with each other for acquiring wealth and worldly possessions, while the true believers strive for God's grace. And number three, paradise is for the upright believers who have never disobeyed Allah, as well as for those who repent and are forgiven by Allah, whose grace and favors multiply the rewards of our good deeds, which are indeed insignificant. Now let us listen to ayahs 22 and 23 of the same surah.
ما أصاب من مصيبة في الأرض ولا في أنفسكم إلا في كتاب من قبل أن نبرأها إن ذلك على الله يسير لكي لا تأسوا على ما فاتكم ولا تفرحوا بما آتاكم والله لا يحب كل مختال فخور.
No affliction visits the earth or yourselves, but it is in a book before we bring it about. That is indeed easy for Allah, so that you may not grieve for what escapes you, nor exult for what comes your way. And Allah does not like any swaggering braggart. These ayahs mean to say that all things happen as consequences that follow in accordance with the laws made by Allah, the All-Wise, whose decrees of occurrences or their postponement and cancellation are pre-recorded in a book from which the announcement has been made to mankind, so that distress could be avoided through good deeds and precautionary measures. This, however, does not mean that the good ones will not suffer disasters, or those afflicted with disasters are bad persons. As Ayah 23 means to say, both misfortune and good fortune are divine tests and may turn out to be illusory, since these are designed to test and ascertain the degrees of faith or the lack of it. Therefore, true believers do not envy those who have material possessions. Neither do they exult if they themselves possess worldly assets, nor do they boast and covet. If the true believers are blessed with material bounties, they share them with others, as they consider wealth and possession to be gifts of Allah. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the events and occurrences of the transient life of the mortal world are known to Allah, the All-Wise, and take place at His command. Number two, a faithless person is dejected when misfortune befalls and exults in wild joy when fortune favors him or her, while a true believer is patient in calamities and is thankful to God for whatever they gain. And number three, Allah the All-Merciful, who tests the degrees of faith or the lack of it through both disasters and bounties, at times averts many a calamity, whether accidental or natural, such as storms, earthquakes, epidemics, and the like, because of earnest prayers and supplications to Him. In conclusion of this week's episode, here is Ayah 24 of Surah Hadid.
الَّذِينَ يَبْخَلُونَ وَيَأْمُرُونَ النَّاسَ بِالْبُخْلِ وَمَن يَتَوَلَّ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْغَنِيُّ الْحَمِيدُ.
Such as are the stingy and beat other people to be stingy, and whoever refuses to comply should know that indeed Allah is the all-sufficient, the all-laudable. This ayah points to the misers and niggardly who not only do not give to the needy from the wealth that God has granted to them, but dissuade others from spending in God's way. In other words, the avaricious and the niggardly not only keep the gifts of Allah from others in society, but also dry up the streams of charity in others. From this ayah, we learn that number one, persuading others to be stingy is worse than being stingy. And number two, God has given wealth and possessions as a trial to determine how a rich person behaves, whether he or she helps the needy and spends for a good cause, or keeps on accumulating riches by being stingy and arrogant.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The study has revealed that the U.S. has waged 400 wars since its founding, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. What does that say about the founding fathers of the U.S. to present-day leaders? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. has what appears to be war as a doctrine, why it has focused on Africa and West Asia to wage these wars, and why it has not won any wars recently, despite waging so many of them. Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we had editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison. We also have journalist and author Daniel Lazar joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines.
featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Daniel Azar, I'll start with you. The name of the study, Introducing the Military Intervention Project, a new data set on U.S. military interventions. Which sounds with a lot of bells and whistles there. Okay. The U.S. undertook almost 400 military interventions from its founding in 1776 to 2019. It sounds like a lot. The research we did supports the numbers. Then the question comes about, why is the U.S. relying on military interventions in such a way, or executing it, I should say, in such a way?
Well, that's about one intervention every 8 months, when you consider the U.S. has been around for about 250 years or so. The U.S. is a state. It's very aggressive. It's violent, like all states are violent. But this violence has certainly exploded since World War II. When the U.S. led the step forth and emerged as the leader of the global crusade against communism. And then it took another leap upwards in 1991 when the Soviet bloc collapsed. The U.S. was the last superpower left standing. So the U.S. Did its best to assert its global hegemony across the world. And that meant a dramatic increase in military conflicts. And then there was yet another increase after 9/11, when the U.S., stepped up its military warfare, and especially with regard to the Middle East, started pouring arms into the region, fostering war, invading it itself, of course, and essentially bringing about chaos from one end of the region to the other.
Let's go to what you pointed out there, Daniel Azar, and I'll ask you, Kevin Barrett, about back in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. was left to be the dominant military power. Why then was there an increase in the military interventions? Why wasn't there a decrease? What led the U.S. towards down that path?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I remember back then that there was a widespread feeling that Americans and the world would be getting a peace dividend. We look forward to a big reduction in government expenditures, big reduction in taxes, and an enhanced civilian economy. And somehow that didn't happen. And I think that the people who profit from these wars, who became part of the national security complex, which is really an imperial kind of bureaucratic and corporate and criminal overlapping set of worlds, that these people profit mightily from war. And they wanted to make sure that those wars continued. So they began pretty half-heartedly in the 1990s with interventions in Eastern Europe and things like that, continuing to rain death on Iraq killing Iraqi children through sanctions, things like that. But I think they recognized that that wasn't sustainable because of the general tenor of public opinion in the U.S., which has always followed George Washington's dictate that the U.S. should never be involved in foreign quarrels. And indeed, the founding fathers believe there should only be a military that gets called up in the event of the U.S. being attacked and invaded externally, as happened in the War of 1812. Of course, that set of beliefs of the public has never really matched reality very well. But I think they had to change that. And so that's why we got the September 11th, 2001 New Pearl Harbor. That was a false flag event that was modeled after the original Pearl Harbor, which had been the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that was actually orchestrated by an 8-point plan put together by the Roosevelt Brain Trust under supervision of British intelligence. And that the Pearl Harbor scam was used to turn around 80% plus U.S. public opinion against entry into World War II. And suddenly overnight, the entire American public, with a very, very few exceptions, welcomed U.S. Involvement in World War II. And then that mentality continued after the war and allowed for this vastly increased level of militarism. So they did the same thing in 2001. They created a new Pearl Harbor, which indeed the very defense intellectuals who orchestrated this had actually openly yearned for in a September 2000 document called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They basically called for a new Pearl Harbor. And so then they got it when their operatives blew up the World Trade Center with explosives and attacked the Pentagon, blamed it on Muslims, which was completely false. Those 19 guys they blamed were not even on the planes. At least there's no evidence that they were. So that event, that great deception, was used to condition the American public, just as Pearl Harbor conditioned them to believe that they had to go out and try to rule the world in order to not be vulnerable to a surprise attack. The same mentality reigned after September 11th, and Americans became completely irrational, gave up their desire for a peace dividend, gave up whatever remnants of belief in George Washington's foreign policy they had. And so the imperial warmongers were free to double their military budget, to increase their biological warfare budget by 10,000% in the wake of the false flag anthrax attack by the U.S. biodefense sector on the U.S. Congress, and do everything that they've done since then, which is essentially turn the U.S. into the most criminal militaristic dictatorship that's ever existed.
Well, I'd like to find out how we got to that point. And Daniel Lazar, it's hard to really try to follow the way that this transpired. But I'm going to go along the lines of the number of U.S. military bases, which is roughly around 800. Where did this number and how did this number really come about? I mean, you know, you go through year by year and there's a think tank of some kind or it's deep inside the Pentagon. Let's have a U.S. base here. Let's have one over there. How does it get to be to the point where there's so many of them and for the U.S. to have the biggest military spending? Or not defense, military spending of around roughly $800 billion. How did the U.S. get to that point?
Well, let me just begin by saying that Kevin Barrett is a friend of mine. I like him very much, but I disagree with him profoundly about Pearl Harbor or 9/11. Pearl Harbor was an attack by the Japanese, and 9/11 was truly an attack by Al-Qaeda's origins are tied up with the U.S. Sponsored war in Afghanistan, but that attack was quite real. It was not carried out by American operatives of any sort. And as for why there are
evidence against those innocent 19 men,
and as why there are 800 bases around the world. Well, after 1991, the U.S. became the global hegemon, and it felt it was its responsibility to patrol the entire globe. And that meant putting into operation a very complicated structure of military domination. And that involved 800 bases or so, give or take 50, around the globe. And the U.S. also set out to outspend the rest of the world. I mean, I think U.S. spending is now it's greater than that of the next 10 nations combined. So the U.S. turned itself into a global military colossus whose purpose is to control the globe, control the earth in a way that is conducive to America's profits, its economic growth, its attempt to further its superpower status.
Let me jump in when you say that, because when you say the U.S. Has all these military bases, which I pose to you as a question, you also said that the U.S. is out to control the world. What right does it give the U.S. through its military to then feel through that it can control the world? I mean, is that the type of thinking? I'm just trying to make sure I'm clear on this.
It gives it no right at all, of course. You're absolutely correct. It's an excellent question. The U.S. has no moral right. It has no legal right under international law. You're correct, but it's a case of might makes right. The U.S. has this huge military structure, which the rest of the world can't say no to, and therefore it uses it to enforce its will around the globe. Now, the problem today is that a growing number of countries are saying no, such as Russia, Iran, and China. So therefore, that has the U.S. deeply upset and is leading to ever more aggressive actions by the imperial center.
So if might is right, Kevin Barrett, doesn't that go hand in hand with U.S. foreign policy to make these countries where U.S. has military bases, as an example, that, okay, this is our line, and you're either with us or you're with them in a sense, but I'm sorry, that's a quote from somebody else. So is that how it goes, parallel with the U.S. Military bases and defense spending, that the countries need to follow the U.S. foreign policy?
Well, of course, the U.S. has used these military bases and other forms of power to push around the governments of other countries in all sorts of different ways. And one of the ways that we haven't heard much about in the Western media is the history of U.S. nuclear threats against other nations. I have a book somewhere on my bookshelves documenting, I forget precisely how many dozens of such direct threats to use nuclear weapons against other nations. And so this is a kind of bullying and intimidation set tactic. It's a little bit like the mafia with its threats. It's obviously corrupt, and it is about various forms of profiteering. And those forms can be obvious, as is the case of the way that the U.S. military is used to keep the billionaire oligarch elite of the West in a position to continue robbing the world blind and robbing their own societies blind as well. We don't tolerate governments that are strong enough to protect their own citizens, much less anybody else, against the depredations of our neoliberal oligarchs. So that part is obvious. There are also all sorts of other ways that people within and around the so-called military-industrial complex profit from this empire. And one of the biggest and least known by consumers of mainstream media is drug smuggling. That is, that it's not that widely known, unfortunately, that since the late 1940s, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has been by far the world's biggest illegal drug smuggler. And I highly recommend the book on Operation Gladio by, I forget, the former Fox News correspondent of all people who wrote it, that documents how the CIA saw that Chiang Kai-shek had managed to finance his war operations using illegal narcotics money, and that whoever did this was going to have a big edge up in ruling the world. And so the CIA got into that game, and they ended up using the Vatican Bank as their biggest single money laundry. I think a lot of Catholics would be shocked to know this. So there's a lot of criminal profiteering that goes on. It's no obviously no coincidence that Vietnam happened right there in the Golden Triangle, where the U.S. was shipping back vast amounts of heroin in the bodies of dead soldiers, in the coffins of dead soldiers. The film Air America documents this. And then it's no coincidence that we went into Afghanistan at a time when the Taliban had shut down the heroin industry. And the first thing that the U.S. forces did was free the drug lords and set them to work. And within 2 years, record profits, record crops were being generated. So there are all sorts of these corrupt ways of profiteering that justify the imperial depredations of the empire. And that's I think these are the kinds of real reasons why the U.S. is doing this, not any kind of belief in the superiority of the American system or the need for a rules-based international order and all this nonsense. They're just a bunch of corrupt criminal types who are making money from it, and they want to continue making money.
Okay, since you talked about profits and money, arms sales for the U.S., it has been a top supplier based on SIPRI to West Asia or Middle East, where the U.S. arms export, Daniel Lazar, increased from 32% to 37% over the last 5 years. This being a report from the year 2019, I should mention, with imports by Middle East and North Africa growing by 25%. Well, guess what? The study that we talked about, the topic of this program, reveals that the U.S. has waged these wars, a quarter of them in West Asia and in Africa. Is this a coincidence, And why then is West Asia and Africa the focus?
Well, first, it's not a coincidence. The U.S. pours arms into these regions in order to destabilize them, and thereby control them all the more more effectively. But the reason is resources. In the case of the Middle East, it's oil. I mean, oil is what capitalism has run on for the last century. It is absolutely crucial to industrial capitalism as it is now constructed. And so therefore, you know, the Middle East has become the great prize. The U.S. has poured, you know, incredible resources, literally trillions of dollars, into militarizing Middle East. And and what are the consequences? The consequences of the region has been torn by one major war after the other. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, have been killed. Entire countries have been laid waste, such as Syria and Lebanon and Yemen. Others like Iraq have been destroyed. Iran has been under an economic siege since the 1980s. And meanwhile, the U.S. is arming to the teeth Saudi Arabia, perhaps the most repressive single government on the face of the earth. And the U.S. does this all in the name of democracy. I mean, it's a complete joke. But the effect of all this is to cause living conditions to plummet in these regions.
Well, then let me ask you this, Kevin Barrett. If the U.S. was not to be involved in these militaristic approaches that it has had, i.e. wars, what kind of world would we be living in now? Because right now, Afghanistan is a mess. Iran is being threatened right and left with either through Israel, which is a U.S. ally, not to mention other countries in West Asia, which are either unstable or teetering on it, such as Syria. We're looking at the U.S., Ukraine, conflict. I'm sorry, it's the Russia-Ukraine conflict, but the U.S. obviously is in there somewhere. And then you have China, and we're seeing what's happening there. But what if the U.S. wasn't involved at all? What kind of world would we be living in now?
Well, there are a lot of indications that it would be much more peaceful and prosperous, certainly in West Asia. If we look at what the U.S. has done to whom and why, what we see over and over is the same pattern, that when a country starts becoming reasonably prosperous because its leadership is putting the interests of its own people first, that's when the U.S. attacks. That's what we did to Saddam Hussein in Iraq. For all of his many faults and crimes, Saddam Hussein had basically eliminated corruption from that country, except within his own family, of course, and had built the living standards, the infrastructure, and the educational levels up to near first world levels. And that's why Iraq had to be destroyed. And likewise with Gaddafi in Libya, who had brought Libya into the 21st century as by far the most prosperous country in Africa. And that's why Libya had to be destroyed as well. Iran has been a surprising success economically, despite the incredible sanctions and the opposition of so much of the world ever since the 1979 revolution. Still, Iran has done reasonably well, and that's why Iran is still facing so much hostility. And then if we look at just what happened in Pakistan, Imran Khan had actually presided over an incredibly successful couple of years where the economic growth shot up to 6-7%. Because Imran Khan was following policies that would benefit the Pakistani people by trading with partners like China that are interested in trade rather than just depredation. And so the U.S. overthrew Imran Khan's government, as it always overthrows and targets governments that put the best interests of their own people first. So if we didn't have this U.S. empire destroying countries and overthrowing governments that are, in fact, working on behalf of their people, we would probably have a much more peaceful and prosperous planet. All of that money that's being wasted in death and destruction would be saved, and the world would be much better off.
Well, this is what the U.S. has said, Daniel Azar, and I'm going to read off a particular organization that I'm going to ask you who you think has released this, where it says, as a title, the U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability, priority countries and region. The U.S. government is moving forward in the spirit of partnership with countries and a regional grouping of countries to implement the 10-year U.S. strategy to prevent conflict and to promote stability. Can you guess what organization has actually stated that?
I would suggest the National Security Council.
USAID.
USAID.
Exactly.
Okay,
from the American classic. People. So they're using this organization, and this is their line, but we know that USAID has been involved in regime change operations in Cuba, in Russia, and perhaps elsewhere. Cuba and Russia distinctly stand out.
Yes. But this is the way America works. I mean, America sees itself as the font of justice and rightness. Everything America does is by definition right. Even when America makes mistakes, it's because it's too good. It's trying too hard to make the world a better place. So occasionally it oversteps. But in general, the fundamental assumption across the entire political spectrum, across the entire corporate press, is that America is good, it is just, it is correct, it is a country that is trying its best to make the world a better place. And so therefore, yes, when it wages war, it's really trying to wage peace. And it's only because other countries oppose its peacemaking efforts that war results. I mean, it's completely narcissistic reasoning. But that is how America works. That is the basic mental function of U.S. society in general.
All right. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. I'm going to thank our guests. Thank you for your input there, Daniel Azar, journalist and author from New York. Kevin Barrett, thank you so much, editor at Veterans Today, who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Ikaba Tabway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I am your host, Zainab. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala defines one of the qualities of believers in Surah Zumar, verse 18, which reads, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Allaveena yastami'una al-qawl, those who listen to what is said, fayattabi'una ahsana, and follow the best of it. Ulaika allaveena hadahumullah, and those are the ones whom Allah has guided. Wa ulaika hum ulul albab, and those are the ones endowed with intellect. And that's what we do in this program. We have a roundtable discussion. We listen to what is being said. We deduce the best things out of it. And that's how we come back to reality. Well, today in our studio, we have with us very two special guests. I have Asma on my right hand and Brother Mehdi Najafi on my left side. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum. It's good to be here.
Wa alaikum assalam, sister. I'm happy to be here with you.
Same here. Asma, would you like to give a little intro? I know you, but
yes,
just for audience.
Yes, of course. I am Asma, and I have been studying English literature for so long. I'm a deep dive fan of literature, and it's been a while that I'm being here in radio as well.
Well,
at the service of the audience
again. Brother Najafi, we want to hear from you.
I'm Mehdi, and that's all I am. I have studied business, finance, and management, and I am a student in the seminary of Qom.
Well, different people have different perspectives about life.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at their perspective, it may guide you or it may misguide you.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam's perspective of life, it definitely has a lot of things to teach us. What is your